Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Jasmine Graham. She's a marine biologist in the field of Elasmo branch ecology and evolution, currently specializing in small tooth sawfish and hammerhead sharks. And we're talking about her new book, Sharks Don't Sink: Adventures of a Rogue Shark Scientist. Jasmine, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Yes, good to talk to you too.
Now, in your prologue, you write that your life was changed forever by a single photograph. What was that photograph?
It was a photo of one of my co-founders, Carly Jackson, doing shark research that I saw on Twitter. It was the first time I'd ever seen a black woman shark scientist other than myself.
What attracted you to sharks? I know that you are attracted to small tooth sawfish and bonnet head sharks. What was it about sharks as opposed to other kinds of fish that attracted you?
I'm really interested in sharks because I feel like they're really misunderstood. There's a lot of fear and hostility around sharks, and they're really just animals trying to live their lives. And so I really felt a connection with them, and I just really wanted to give them better PR.
I often wonder if, like, the film Jaws had not come out, if things would have been a whole lot better for sharks.
Yeah, I mean, even Peter Benchley, who wrote the book that Jaws is based off of, he actually felt so guilty about how much it impacted people's view of sharks that he went on to become a lifelong supporter of shark conservation in an effort to sort of make up for the damage that the book did.
I know the book was one thing, but I think the movie really, I mean, it's amazing to this day. First of all, there's Shark Week on television. I mean, there's just like this hyper amount of attention paid to these poor sharks. And people, it's like snakes. People just kill them on sight. It's amazing. And they're really interesting creatures, as I found out from your book.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it was really powerful cinematography, and it just struck a chord with the community, and it led to the creation of an entire genre of movies, shark movies.
Now, I want to ask you before we mess up with time, I want to talk to you about Minorities in Shark Sciences, or MISS. How was it created? How did that organization finally come about?
So after that fateful day, whenever I saw that picture of Carly on Twitter, we kept up in conversation, Carly and the other two co-founders that we had met online through this interaction. We started having conversations about, you know, what it was like for us going into the field and going through our education and all of those things. We realized we had a lot of similarities. And so what started out as a joke on Twitter of, oh, we should start a club, reality, we realized, you know, we're experiencing a lot of the same challenges.
Right.
And it was actually really validating to be able to talk to people about that. And we wanted to create that same space for others. And so that's when we decided we're going to form this organization, Minorities in Shark Sciences. And that was 4 years ago, and now we have about 500 members representing 33 different countries and almost all U.S. states and territories.
That's amazing. Now, your memoir traces your often battling racism, sexism, and your goal to become an ichthyologist. But there's also a great memories of you and your father fishing. And I just want to talk about that a minute, because I found those scenes really, really fascinating and wonderful. Talk to me about your father and you fishing.
Yeah, well, I loved hanging out with my dad and fishing. My dad loved to fish. His mother loved to fish. Fishing is really in our DNA. And so getting to spend that time on the pier, just looking out over the water, catching fish, hearing my dad's stories, it really, I think, was a pivotal part of my childhood, especially since, you know, I was a military brat, so we moved around all the time. So, like, my home base was that pier fishing. That's where I felt like at home. And so I just really connected with the ocean. I connected with fish in particular in that period of time. And then I also was connected to my family because we have this long history of being fishers. And so it was this ancestral connection to all of the people that fished in those waters before me as well. And so it was just really a holistic way to connect with the natural world and all of those that came before me.
The important thing is your father had a lot of local knowledge about all the fish that he would be attempting to catch. And that was an important piece of information. Did anybody ever record or put down what your father knew about fish?
I'm actually working on that now. So I started a project where I'm interviewing elders in the fishing community that my family has been and trying to get their stories and learn about what fish did you used to catch a lot of?
Yeah.
Are you catching less fish? What's been happening? How has fishing changed? And trying to get all of that knowledge down of, you know, when the wind's blowing this way, you know that this fish is biting, all of that. Because it's really important knowledge that science doesn't have, because we're not out there as scientists every day for hours and hours on end for 50 years in the same spot. You know, they have knowledge that we could never get. And so I'm working on recording that information and publishing it, because unfortunately in the science community, we have this weird elitism where we're like, you don't have a degree and whatnot, so we don't think that you know what you're talking about. But by codifying this into the scientific literature, it can't be ignored that these have this information and they have value and things to say and things to add to the conversation.
And that information was shared a lot by other fishermen that he would talk to. So there is a whole body of knowledge about the movements of fish, about fish and weather, fish in the sea, that was, you're right, it's going to be lost unless you write it down.
Exactly. And the fishing community in Myrtle Beach, unfortunately, is collapsing.
And is that because all these buildings were built up around the pier?
Yeah. We have, you know, all the commercialization of the shorelines. There's constant beach renourishments that are changing the marine environment. We've got the fish stocks collapsing globally, but certainly in Myrtle Beach as well. And that's affecting the community, especially because that community lives in a food desert. So the source of the ocean is directly connected to their health and well-being. And so we're also seeing the community higher rates of diabetes, heart disease, because they're not getting nutritious food because they're losing that access to seafood from the ocean.
What fish did you catch as a child? And like what, I know these things are so important that when you're exposed as a child to nature and the outdoor world, those things that you come in contact with are so important to you. But what fish did you catch and what fish did you like to eat? That's a weird question.
We've had a lot of spot and flounder.
Oh,
a lot of fish. And I love flounder in particular. Super, super tasty fish. And then the spot, they would run certain times of the year. So, when we say run, it's actually like a movement, a migration that they all make, and they make past Myrtle Beach. And so there's just tons and tons of them passing by all at once, for a period of about a month to a month and a half. And so we would get the call, the spot are running. We rush down to the pier, and we start fishing.
Wow. You burnt out at one point, it seemed, that you might leave the sciences entirely, the American Elasma Branch Society, and for good reason. I mean, you faced tremendous blowback, both for being a woman and both for being a person of color. Can you just talk a little bit about the kind of challenges you faced?
Yeah, I think that the hardest part of everything is that whenever you're going through these things and experiencing these things, people constantly telling you that it's not happening and that you're reacting. And so it's like a double whammy of this person said this thing or did this thing and it hurt. but then I go to try and get someone to stick up for me or there to be consequences for those actions, and I'm met with this resistance of, well, maybe they didn't mean it that way, or maybe you're taking it the wrong way. And so that was really the most frustrating part, is not just the action, but the reaction. And that's where I started having that burnout, because I had this really, really big issues happening, and I felt like no one cared. And there was no one there that was going to stand up for me and speak out. And as someone early in their career, I felt like I was being silenced, mm-hmm. and that people weren't valuing my experiences or weren't listening to me, and they weren't believing me, which was really frustrating.
That seems like that was one of the importance of the organization miss, that you finally were able to talk to other people who had similar experiences.
Yeah, exactly.
And to be validated in that way is really crucial. Has there been progress in the sciences that you're involved with? I mean, I know it's slow progress, but is there progress?
Yeah, I think there has been progress. We're seeing changes in the institution level of different institutions saying, yeah, you're right, there is a better way to do this. We should start thinking about the biases that exist in our process. We should start holding people accountable. We should start creating these codes of conduct. That is starting to happen. And I think that we still have a long way to go, but at least we have some organizations and institutions taking that first step.
And in addition to all of that, you had a person, a professional person, the name that you have for him is Dr. Minion, not his real name, who stole your research.
Yeah.
I'm glad you outed him in this book. That was like amazing.
Yeah. And that sort of thing, unfortunately, is not uncommon. I know a lot of people who have similar stories, especially people that are early career, especially people from marginalized communities where this happens. It's unfortunately pretty prevalent. And it's something that I think that we, in order to combat as a field of research, that we got to start holding people accountable, mm-hmm. and we start thinking to ourselves, you know, just because someone publishes a lot, brings a lot of money into the institution, that does not absolve them from poor behavior and their consequences. So I think that we have to be really mindful of that as we move through as a science field.
I know that you talked about in the book about getting a code of conduct in the American Elasma Branch Society, and it's obviously needed. But it was a struggle getting everybody to think that they needed a code of conduct.
Yeah, it was. Unfortunately, when people haven't been held accountable for a really long time, accountability feels like oppression to them.
Right.
Like, how dare you tell me that I can't grab female students in any way that I want? How dare you tell me that I can't make a racist comment? I should be able to do whatever I want. Like, no, you shouldn't be. That's the problem. And so whenever met with this accountability, the people, they really tell on themselves, because if your reaction to, hey, you should behave with a certain level of decorum is, you can't tell me what to do, obviously you want to misbehave. The only reason you would say that. That's the issue here, is that you have people that have never been held accountable. They have a lot of power, and they do everything in their power to not be held accountable.
This is probably an obvious answer to this question, but I want your input about it. Is it your feeling that in a lot of the natural sciences, the natural history sciences, the same situation's going on?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Jasmine Graham. She's a marine biologist in the field of Elasma Branch Ecology and Evolution, currently specializing in small tooth sawfish and hammerhead sharks. And we're talking about her new book, Sharks Don't Sink, Adventures of a Rogue Shark Scientist. Jasmine, I got to talk to you about small tooth sawfish. When I read about it in your book and you you know, collecting them to take measurements and stuff like that. What kind of a species? How big is a small-toothed sawfish?
So small-toothed sawfish can get up to 15 feet long.
Oh.
and so they're pretty big. and like a third of that is just the saw on their face.
I've always been fat. As a kid, I had a saw fit from a sawfish. They used to collect them and sell them. This was a long time ago. I've been fascinated by that fish for so long. Now, you write about sawfish and mangroves. Why are mangroves important to sawfish?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So mangroves are trees that grow on the edge of the land. So they're part of that land-sea interface. They have these roots that hang out into the water. And those roots actually provide really great hiding places for animals when they are young. So sawfish, yes, small-toothed sawfish gets to be 15 feet long, but it's not born 15 feet long. It's born pretty small, actually. And so they've got to hide from predators. They've got to hide from saltwater crocodiles, from sharks, all of those sorts of things. And so they can actually go up in those roots.
Wow.
That are sticking out into the water, and they can hide. And then the larger animals can't get them. So it's kind of like encasing yourself in a little cage, a little protective cage.
Yeah. But of course, mangroves are now endangered. Mangrove stands of any substance are endangered.
Yes. So we're losing our mangroves at an alarming rate. A lot of reasons for that. Development of the coastline, so people are actually cutting down mangrove forests. We have changes in our water quality because, I mean, mangroves are plants.
Yeah.
So if you don't have good water quality, they're sucking in bad water, and that's going to kill them. And then we also have changes in temperature because plants are also, they can get heat stress. If we have our tropics warming up, those mangroves, they can't survive outside of their normal temperature range.
Now, have you seen changes in the movements and populations of these two fish that you specialize in over, like, say, the last 15, 20 years? I mean, are they a lot less common than they used to be?
So for the sawfish, small-toothed sawfish are critically endangered. So they're right. As bad off as you can be without being extinct. There are very few of them left. Since the Industrial Revolution, we've lost about 90% of our population of small-toothed sawfish. Their range has shrunk dramatically. They used to be found all along the Gulf of Mexico, down Central America to South America, all the way to Brazil. They used to be all throughout the Caribbean. They used to be up the East Coast, all the way to at least North Carolina. And now you can only find them regularly in Florida waters and in the Bahamas. So there's two places in the world now where you can find them consistently. And that's really scary. And fortunately, in the United States, due to things like our Florida gillnet ban, the creation of the Everglades National Park, the wildlife refuges, the sanctuaries, we started to stabilize our population. And it started, you know, looking like a good positive outlook. But now we have this new threat, which the sawfish are facing, which is the spinning disease, where there's this neurotoxin that's coming from these little algae, these little planktonic things that are in our water, and they're getting sick. Their brains are being affected by this neurotoxin, and they'll spin around, and they'll get really disoriented, and then they'll die. We lost a lot of sawfish this past year to that disease, and we don't have that many to lose. So it's really scary what's been happening this past year. We had a huge loss in our sawfish population this year.
It is part of the reason for the bloom of that toxic material that's causing the disease. Is it that the temperature of the water is rising, or is there runoff from agricultural land, or what?
That's a really good question, and the answer is it's probably a combination of things.
Oh, God.
We're just now starting to understand this problem. I mean, the research just came out literally like within the past month of where they finally figured out what it was that was causing them to spin. So trying to figure out the cause of the cause. We're still working on that, but it could be a number of things. We did have an ocean heat wave about a year ago.
Oh, God.
We have had some extreme weather events. We've had issues with pollution. You know, all of these things could be possible reasons, or it could be a combination.
What about the bonnet head? I'm going to talk a minute about that because most people probably have not heard. People have heard of sawfish, maybe not that species. But the bonnet head is one of those things that I don't think a lot of people have heard about. Is it related to the hammerhead shark?
Yes. So bonnet heads are part of the hammerhead family.
Okay.
A lot of times people don't realize this, but the hammerhead family actually has 10 members in it. So it's not just one hammerhead. There are actually 10 different species within the hammerhead family. And bonnet heads are one of them. They're super cute. Their heads aren't quite as wide as a hammerhead, which is why they're called bonnet heads, because instead of a hammer, it looks like they're wearing a little hat. And they're very cute. Their population is pretty stable here in Florida, which is good. But, you know, a lot of our animals are under threat.
Yeah. You write in the book that you have a lot of bonnet head qualities, but you think of yourself as more of a sawfish.
Yes, I do.
Explain that, Jasmine.
Yeah, mostly because sawfish spend a lot of time sitting still.
Okay.
And I love laying.
Okay.
I love laying. I love resting. And sawfish are really good at that.
But you said you have a lot of bonnet head qualities.
Yes. Bonnet heads are often confused and just kind of bumbling around trying to figure things out. And I feel like that's me as well.
Can you say a few words? MISS, the organization, runs workshops, and they're very important. Can you talk about what those workshops are and why they're needed?
Yeah, so our workshops serve a couple of different purposes. One, it brings together people of color so they can meet each other, network with each other. They're all interested in going into the shark science field. They get to network with other shark scientists that we have on board, learn from them about their research, about how to get involved in the field. And then they also get hands-on experience to learn how to actually safely handle sharks, how to collect data.
Wow.
Wow. Deploy different fishing gear. So, yeah, it's a really fun getting to know each other event. And then also you get a lot of practical hands-on experience.
Whoa.
We talk about things like how to build a resume and you know, all of these sort of soft skills that are required to do work in this field.
Is it possible for people listening to support the organization?
Yes, absolutely. You can go on our website, missalasmo.org, which you can also easily find by Googling Minorities in Shark Sciences. It'll come up. We have a link to donate. We also have, if for those workshops and for our other programs, we do in-kind donations. So if you want to donate to the swag bags that our participants get, things like notebooks, pens, you know, things that are going to help them be successful during that program, we have opportunities for that as well.
Now, we're almost out of time, but I want to ask you, there are all sorts of people that appear in your book, but who is Eugenie Clark?
Yes, so Eugenie Clark was one of the pioneers of shark research. She actually founded Moat Marine Laboratory, which is the first place that I worked after I finished school. And some truly phenomenal Japanese-American woman who taught us that sharks not only think, but they learn. Her techniques are used in aquariums all around the world now to target feed sharks, because she proved that sharks actually can identify shapes and colors and go towards them and be trained to go towards them. And she's really just an inspiration. to everyone, but particularly to women and people of color.
It's amazing more people don't know her name.
She
sort of seems like a major figure that'd be the kind of person that you want to look up to and you want to know more about.
Yes, absolutely. We actually have an intern who is working on a musical about her.
Whoa.
She also feels like not enough people know her name.
That I need to know about. When that gets ready, can you make sure you contact me? Because I would love to cover that on the show. That sounds like a cool idea. That's a great idea. I want to read a quote from you towards the end of the book. It says, whether the problem is racism, sexism, or the destruction of the natural world, inaction can be just as harmful as negative action. Doing nothing by default supports the status quo. And that sort of seems to be the whole feeling behind this book.
Yes, absolutely. I think a lot of people think that they can stand in the middle of the road. And my mom always says, if you stand in the middle of the road, you're definitely getting run over.
And your mother was right.
So you got to pick a side. You have to make a choice. You have to make an active choice to support people, to advocate for people. If you don't do that and you continue to let terrible things happen around you, you're part of the problem as well.
With that, we'll end. My guest tonight is Jasmine Graham. She's a marine biologist in the field of the Lasma Ranch ecology and evolution, currently specializing in small-toothed sawfish and hammerhead sharks. And we've been talking about her new book. It's a great read. Sharks Don't Sink, Adventures of a Rogue Shark Scientist. Jasmine, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. You too.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.